The Sunstone Foundation presents Pillars of My Faith, Part 1. Recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium, held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We take you now to the University of Utah campus where the program is about to begin.
Our speakers this evening are Richard Craycroft, Sharon Swenson, Lawrence Young, and Kathleen Flake. I first met Dick Craycroft 23 years ago when he came to the University of Wisconsin, where I was teaching. He was already then a faculty member at BYU and came to Wisconsin to finish graduate work. I learned to know his ready wit, that he was a willing church member and a good friend. He returned to BYU, spent 5 years as chairman of the English department and 5 years as dean of the College of Humanities. During the last 3 years, he's been on leave as president of the Switzerland Zurich Mission. He was also president of the Provo East Stake for 10 years, from 73 to 83, and as such, he spoke at the funeral of my uncle, Aaron Farr. And I remember with pleasure that that's a funeral I enjoyed. He's a teacher of creative writing and American literature with an emphasis on Mark Twain and the American West. With Neil Lambert, he initiated the teaching of Mormon literature as a discipline. They published an anthology, which is unfortunately now out of print. He and Janice Alger have 3 children, 25, 23, and 21, all of whom are unfortunately still at home. Sharon Swenson, who will follow him, is assistant professor of theater and film at Brigham Young University with an emphasis on history, theory, and criticism. She's now finishing a PhD at the University of Utah. Her dissertation is on time and grace in European art films. She serves as Relief Society president in the Salt Lake City ward where she lives. She's married to Paul Sorensen, who's planning a new magazine along the lines of the old Utah holiday, which he left when it changed its character. They have 2 children. Now, Larry Young teaches courses at BYU in the sociology of religion, of education, and advanced statistics. He's also another University of Wisconsin student who has been doing graduate work there over a period of years, and this Monday he's returning to defend his doctoral dissertation, which is on post-Vatican II Catholic Church, with a focus on the allocation of power in religious organizations, assessing the degree of success the Catholic Church has had in implementing the changes called for in the Second Vatican Council. With a Catholic colleague, he will publish this fall a book on the Catholic priest in the United States, which focuses on the vocation crisis in the Catholic Church. He's an elders quorum instructor, but he says his all-time favorite church calling was as blazer leader, a time when boys still engage in hero worship. Kathleen Flake is a Brigham Young undergraduate, a University of Utah Law School graduate in 1980. She's been an attorney in Washington, D.C., is presently Assistant General Counsel of the Home Loan Bank Board. She teaches the Gospel Doctrine class in the Washington, D.C. Second Ward. It's our privilege to hear now in that sequence from these 4 speakers.
We've only been home 5 weeks, and I'm still wearing my mission blues, but tonight I'm wearing a blue shirt as a step toward normalcy. I've called this extended testimony, The Patterns of My Faith, Surprises of the Spirit. I stood before them at the end of a large Bierstube on an upper floor of the Munich Holtz Hotel in Steyr, Austria, enjoying once more the kind of spiritual surprise which has startled my life and faith with refreshing frequency. As all have not faith, I suppose the Lord determined in my case, let us allow this mortal and his faithless kind occasional jolts of joy. Otherwise, they'll never make it. So there I stood on that wintry Sunday morning in 1957, presenting a message on Jesus Christ in my 8th month missionary German to a small assembly of Austrians in a chilly, cluttered barroom, carefully observed by a black leather-coated, expressionless Austrian Geheimpolizist. In the midst of my presentation on the need for a Savior in our lives, I was overwhelmed, not for the first time in my brief mission, by the sheer beauty of the gospel I was outlining, by the wondrous nature of the Savior's mission, and by the monumental significance of his sacrifice for me and everyone in the room, including the cop Suddenly I was undergoing an experience which I can only label as transcendent. And oh, that I were an angel experience in which I felt the impress of the Holy Spirit and the thrill up the spine, the cool moisture on my forehead, the tremor of joy, the shock of recognition throughout my being. By then I knew the signs, all of which affirmed that I was at that moment a kind of prophet, albeit a very minor one, a testator of eternal truth, a witness for Jesus Christ. Then just as suddenly I entered into another new stage of transcendence. Even as I looked at my minuscule congregation and saw the confirming spirit working on each face, I'm not sure about the cop, I or some part of me was out of my body at the back of the room, elevated into the corner, watching the whole event at a remove. Part of me was actually looking at the backs of my Austrian friends, seeing me standing before that attentive group, while the other me in the rear corner was filled with a confirmation that what the young missionary was saying in fervent but labored German was true. That other, somehow spiritually objective me, was filled with amazement at the changes which those truths spoken about with authority of deep conviction had wrought upon that same young man who a year earlier was struggling with himself and drifting, frustrated and aimless, in and out of the gospel net. At that moment I realized joy. Like Enos or Alma or Paul, I knew that it was but a type of the joy which comes to every man and woman who, through the ministrations of the Holy Ghost, realizes Christ and God and the restoration and the vision of the spiritual life. Then in a moment I was back in my earthbound body, looking again through my own eyes into the faces of the little congregation. I knew more than ever that all those truths which we encompass by the term the gospel were really truth. With a capital T, truth in a sense far beyond what I had hitherto comprehended. Truth in the sense of becoming, as my mission president Jesse R. Curtis always said, truer by the minute. I began to understand that such truth is accessible by tracing the unchanging spiritual patterns by which our God deals with his mortal children. Patterns which I came to call surprises of the Spirit, road signs and course correctors on the way to eternal lives. Those close encounters of the nearly third kind, spiritually gathered, pondered, and treasured, can sweep one beyond faith to a certitude, which has enabled me, at least, to take a firmer grip on the iron rod of life, especially when the fog gets thick and the rod becomes slippery. Such surprises of the Spirit have become pillars of my faith ever since my mission and earlier. Excited from my early youth by books and predetermined before the foundations of the earth and by inclination and influential siblings to the parlous life of an English major at the University of Utah, I attached myself at East High School to some very bright young men and women and a brilliant English teacher. And despite forays into football and student government, and fascination with the opera, began to enjoy long, albeit one-sided, after-school chats about literature and philosophy. I enjoyed these heady introductions to audacious and heretical ideas and thoughts, and felt myself stretched beyond my capacities. These intellectual adventures prepared me somewhat for college and my particular company of brilliant young men and teachers, who in endless late-night, after-date discussions fanned my skepticism through their articulate, reasoned, and burning disbelief and intellectual independence and utter disdain for the church. They introduced me to big drafts of doubt and a few other drafts, too. And I began a short-lived rebellion against church and familial standards. But the more I warmed my hands at their intellectual fires, the chillier I grew. And I began to learn by my own spiritual discomfort just how cold and dark life can be without the presence of light. I gradually learned that gospel standards had become my incontrovertible standards by which I gauged my own happiness and success. Night after night, I would lie abed and run through a catechism about the existence of God, purpose in the universe, the divinity of Christ, the calling of Joseph Smith, Jr., and about the origins of the Book of Mormon and the black and the priesthood problem. And night after night, I found myself concluding my catechism by kneeling in prayer, feeling like a world-class hypocrite, though, of course, even there I fell wonderfully short, and asking God for comfort, hope, direction, and peace of mind. I continued to attend church meetings where an understanding bishop overlooked my temporary confusions, he did not call them hypocrisies, and asked me to reason to, and called me to responsible positions, which I performed scrupulously, and thus kept a fingernail grip on the outward church below, even as I was probing my inward and private heresies. It was a dangerous tightrope walk. Eventually, I decided, as most believers seem to, that my questions could not be resolved by the intellect. I would have to opt for faith. I soon realized that opting for faith was impossible without making a commitment. I asked the Lord for strength to change my course. He began to unfold his pattern for me by wrenching me from my slough of despair through creating an upheaval in my personal life, which enabled me to start anew. And seizing the moment, I made the decision to opt for faith, to test the Lord by taking some definite, though tentative, steps towards him. Within a few days, to my amazement, I felt the burden of doubt and rebellion lift and watched the lights go on one by one, as God took some giant steps toward me. I was amazed how very soon I felt so very well. A few Sundays after my decision, I was asked to offer a benediction in sacrament meeting. For me, it was a symbolic reaffirmation, and I pondered the occasion and prayed about it. And to my surprise, I was filled during that prayer with a power and joy and warmth and happiness I had not hitherto enjoyed. I had learned the major truth about faith. When we take one small Father may I step towards him, we may expect a giant yes you may step towards us. A few months later, I learned that Paul had summed up what I had learned in his words to the Romans, since emblazoned in my soul. For to be carnally, worldly minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace. It was only a matter of weeks before I knew that part of my commitment to faith would be volunteering myself for missionary service. The newborn Christian within me shouted, yes, but the carnal man groaned, no, for that part of me dreaded the calling, which seemed to stretch before me like a 30-month sentence of 24-hour-a-day seminary classes. With all due respect to CES. Both sides of me, however, resolved to go, as a lamb to the slaughter, with my conscience full of offense, for I knew that accepting a mission call was, in fact, put up or shut up time for me. I went in faith, though I frankly did not expect very much out of the experience. But I reasoned, if faith precedes the miracle, I'd better see a miracle or two along the way. Those miracles weren't long in coming. I was called to the Swiss-Austrian mission and went, determined to place hard work on the altar. To my surprise, hard work with sympathetic companions led to increased faith and increasingly to nurturing surprises of the Spirit. To those promised miracles, as the Lord stepped toward me and more than met the conditions of his promise. My first mission, I have waited 33 years to use that humble-sounding, self-aggrandizing phrase. My first mission became a marvelous unfolding of the Spirit, a time of discovering the patterns of joy which have marked my course ever since. I date my life from that mission. I have learned that as I took my finger from my own pulse and became anxiously engaged in the work of the ministry, I found my true and original self and seemed to enjoy more and more spiritual surprises, shorings up of the faith. I delighted to find that my companions and I could actually teach others that same pattern. One example is Karl Lederhilger, a leader of the Seventh-day Adventist congregations in Upper Austria. Invited to meet him by his wife, who had attended one of our Tuesday lectures, we armed ourselves with Sabbath-day scriptural references and, fasting and fearful, rode our bikes to his home. As we had feared, our lesson on the Godhood was immediately challenged, and we were soon futilely arguing about the Sabbath. In the middle of the conflict, however, my companion, inspired, sent me to my bicycle saddlebags to fetch my outline of the plan of salvation, and I taught the plan to the Lederhilger family. A bit fearful that I was feeding, surprises of the Spirit began to occur. Carl, his face keen with interest, began to supply from memory the supporting scriptures, even some we hadn't thought of. He would gently interrupt and clarify for his family various aspects of the plan, affirming the points as he talked. The Spirit of God gradually filled the room until it was almost tangible. When I broached the need for vicarious baptism for the dead, Carl suddenly leaped to his feet, tears springing to his eyes, and recited from memory 1 Corinthians 15:29. Else what shall they do which are baptized for the dead? I have studied for years, he cried, to find out what that scripture means. And now these two young men have made it crystal clear. This gospel is true, Mutti. These young men have brought us the truth to prize. The chill up the spine, the cold sweat on the forehead, the trembling through my soul. Only this time everyone in the room shared these manifestations. The family was baptized a few weeks later. They had stepped in faith toward God, and he had drawn near and given them the greater perspective, before which their earlier concerns about the Sabbath paled into relative insignificance. With many others, they had learned that God's patterns are not so mysterious after all. For if he does move in mysterious ways his wonders to perform, he clearly, after all, plants his footsteps on the sea and walks upon the storm. And from time to time, he allows us to watch him walk and shout Hosanna. So I believe in part because I have watched God's patterns at work in my life and in the lives of others. I know because the patterns have been proven trustworthy. It is a simple pattern. The individual makes a gesture toward belief and faith. The Spirit bears witness. The mighty change experienced and described by Alma the Younger follows. Then the surprises of the Spirit crop up from time to time to remind the believer that though he or she is 20 or 40 or 60 years out from home, our mutual Father will blow across the coals of our spirits, spark a surprise or shock of recognition in our souls, as if to say, here, my child, is a whiff of truth, an essence of remembrance, a tangible something to remind you that I'm here, that you're on course, that your feet are still treading, however imperfectly, those paths which will lead to joy in mortality and in eternity. It's a simple pattern, as the old Shaker song, Simple Gifts, puts it. 'Tis the gift to be simple. 'Tis the gift to be free. 'Tis the gift to come down where you ought to be. And when we find ourselves in the place just right, we'll be in the valley of love and delight. Although the pattern is simple, keeping my life simple, in harmony, attuned to ever new surprises of the Spirit, is more complex. In my own post-mission life, I seem to become more earthbound. As a student, husband, father, professor, I learned at three universities the appropriate skepticism. I learned to revel in the pursuit of truth, lowercase. I learned I had to labor to keep my spiritual equilibrium, my equipoise. I learned that everyone else undergoes the same struggle on the way to faith. In my attempts to balance my in-the-world inclinations with my not-of-the-world desires, I have found that my religious life was not described by either of the categories identified by Richard Paul as Liahona or Iron Rod. Intellectually, I felt I should be a card-carrying Liahona, grounding my faith in reason and empirically verifiable experience, confessing that I have only what Dr. Paul has called a somewhat tenuous connection with the Holy Ghost. On the other hand, I felt that inasmuch as I saw the church as a visible and tangible earthly arm of our presently invisible God, I was close to the Iron Rodder's basic institutional-centered tenets: follow the brethren, and obedience is the first law of heaven. But besides my own discomfort with Procrustean beds or pigeonholing, I simply felt that neither category defined my more than tenuous connection with the Spirit. I am, I recently discovered in an article in Dialogue, a member of a group called, for want of a better term, Charismatics. At least that is what Jeffrey Jacob calls my kind of Latter-day Saint in his summer article, 1989 article, Explorations in Mormon Social Character, Beyond the Liahona and Iron Rod. Jacob defines the charismatic group as Latter-day Saints who, quote, take a less mediated approach to religious experience by elevating the place of the Holy Spirit in their lives, not simply to confirm church directives, but as an independent source of guidance and inspiration. Falling somewhere on the continuum between the reason and experience orientation of the Liahona and the faith orientation of the Iron Rodder, The charismatics rely on personal inspiration and, quote, quietly endure uncertainty rather than systematically engaging doubt. In pursuing truth, they seek a personal relationship with Christ and turn to, quote, cultivating a sense of God in their lives, seeking the presence of the divine, and confident that God is not remote and uninvolved in our lives. Hurrah, I said to myself on reading this, I'm charismatic. No, said my wife, you're enigmatic. At least you are a charismatic groupie. Whatever, I whispered charismatically. Of course, true charismatic that I am, I do not pretend to understand the reason behind the pattern of God's hand in our lives. But I know that he monitors and often gives guidance to our actions, to our lives. Unquestionably, he answers prayers. He gives comfort and direction. He prompts and directs. And when I tally up instances of his interventions in my life, his outright manipulation of my life, I give thanks. He told me moments after I met her that Janice was to be my wife, although I played fair and didn't force that knowledge on her until much later, unlike most of my BYU students. He told that same woman and me that we were to cancel building plans and move to our present home. He commanded me at a very critical juncture through my wife to command our daughter to be healed, and she was. He cheated for me by telling me on the morning of my final PhD examination the wording of the major bibliographic essay for the day. And I studied that material and aced the examination in the name of the Lord. It wasn't fair to the Gentiles, but it was all right for me. He responded to my plea to help me find spiritual balance amidst my PhD studies at the University of Wisconsin by having Bishop Arvel Erickson and Brother Ed Kimball call me to serve for 1 year as a seminary teacher, thereby urging me to a renewal of gospel studies. He told me in a startling daytime vision not only that Thomas S. Monson would call me as stake president of the Provo East Stake on the following Saturday, but also showed me which men I should call as my counselors and which high counselors I should release and which men I should sustain. And it scared me to death. But I had no doubts, for the pattern was by then crystal clear. It was exactly the same pattern he had followed in showing me in detail my calling to the bishopric of the East 27th Ward, in showing me that I would become the bishop of the Provo Bonneville Ward, and that I would become the president of the Switzerland Zurich Mission. And when it came time to call Relief Society presidents and young women leaders and quorum presidents and some 25 bishops, and to make monthly transfers of young missionaries, he has given me time after time refreshing surprises of the Spirit. No true revelations were the same, but the patterns were similar, and it has always left to me to take the initial steps, humble myself, plead with the Lord, and then wait with patience the inexorable surprise. In his own good time, in his own good way, the Lord makes his will known, and I have been able to say, thus saith the Lord, many times. The pattern works. This joy of the Lord pressing near is so rewarding and refreshing that I have slowly learned to shun the spiritual bruisings which I inevitably receive when I allow my mortality to assert itself and venture into arc-steadying, criticism of the church and her leadership, questioning doctrine, carping about church policies, programs, and my fellow mortals. After indulging in such, and who doesn't, I inevitably sense a withdrawal of the spirit, a cessation of faith and growth and peace, and feel the need to hasten back to the pattern of renewal, to spiritual growth and refreshment on which I have come to rely. Though my spiritual life is only partially dependent on the outward church below, I know that the church is the arm of the Lord, the deliverer of his ordinances, a schoolmaster for my soul, an afforder of opportunities to serve and be served by others, and its leaders are his anointed. I find that harmony with Christ's church is essential to my spiritual well-being. The same pattern holds in the mission field. Over the past 3 years, I have watched as elder after sister has learned to climb up out of finger-on-pulse self-centeredness to lose him or herself in the long, hard, bruising, tough, but character-sculpting and Christocentric work of the ministry to be rewarded by those surprises and gifts of the Spirit. Spiritual promptings, insights, flashes of intelligence, dreams, visions, healings, witnesses of the divinity of the Book of Mormon and the restoration, miracles of conversion, which seem to the missionary to occur only occasionally, but which appear to the mission president as chief gatherer, correlator, and reporter, as almost overwhelming manifestations of the intricate involvement of the Lord in the lives of these young men and women and older couples as he manipulates them into position in order to render service to and beget change in the lives of his children. Day after week after year, large and small events take place as the elders and sisters make their Father May I steps into the twilight zone of faith, only to learn that God is immediately behind the veil, and that here is a moment which affirms truth and strengthens purpose and holds up the hands when they hang down. I have often wished that there were a central recording facility at church headquarters to which the saints could call in their surprises of the Spirit. These experiences indexed and printed as a modern Magnalia Christi or Remarkable Providences would, I am confident, fill many volumes yearly and stem any talk as to whether the Spirit is lively in the Church of Christ. As a mission president, I was likewise lifted from time to time above the routine concerns of the health of the missionaries with numbers of baptisms, companionship problems, and the handful of missionaries who were always paddling around in the belly of the whale. The pattern held. Typical is an event that occurred just over a year ago now, while several of us attended a performance of Verdi's Rigoletto at the Luzern Opera House. Following the first act, the manager approached me and explained, "Miss Marina Jajic, our soprano, has become seriously ill and will not be able to continue her performance." Herr Montgomery, who was a Latter-day Saint and our host and who was performing the role of Rigoletto that evening, has requested that the Mormon mission president give Miss Jajic a blessing. "Follow me if you will be so kind." He was as uncomfortable as I was. Surprised and a bit apprehensive, my assistants and I accompanied the manager backstage to the women's dressing room. There, slumped in a corner chair, was Marina Jajic, collapsed and deathly pale and looking like a Gilda who had prematurely fallen victim to the assassin's dagger. We introduced ourselves, learned that she spoke little German but passable English, and I established that she had faith in Christ, faith that he could heal her, and that she desired a blessing. So there, amidst the hubbub of a dressing room full of partially clad but heavily made-up singer-actresses, a Mormon mission president and two Mormon elders recently pulled from their pleasant opera boxes and ministered in English to a deathly ill Roman Catholic soprano from Yugoslavia who desperately wanted to be made well. Then the surprise of the Spirit occurred. I was suddenly able to shut out the confusion of the dressing room and, filled with peace and conviction, knew exactly what the Lord wanted me to say. I gave expression to the feelings which somehow surged up from some flowing well within my soul. And I said things which surprised all of us, given the obvious condition of this woman. "Be healed. You will begin to regain strength immediately," I heard myself saying. "And you will recover and will not only continue your performance this evening, but you will sing magnificently. And as you reflect on this later, you will know that this blessing comes directly from God through Jesus Christ, and you will want to learn more about Christ's desires for you in your life." I was loading the blessing. We concluded the administration. She thanked us, her eyes still partially closed, her face pallid, and as we left the dressing room, I felt confidence and calm which belied her appearance, and my rational self admitted that the fulfillment of my blessing seemed highly unlikely. Assuring the hand-wringing manager that we would not object if the house doctor looked at her, we made our way back to our seats, reassured the others in our party, and began praying hard that the Lord would indeed grant the very specific promises of that bold blessing. After a 15-minute wait, the manager, who had already appeared on stage to inform us of Miss Jajic's illness, reappeared to proclaim, "I am pleased to announce that Miss Jajic is feeling better and will be able to continue in her role as Gilda." Moments later, we enthusiastically applauded Marina's reappearance on the stage, but I was also applauding our God for stretching his finger into our lives and granting a special request. In accordance with the blessing, Marina performed magnificently, as did our Mormon baritone. It was a memorable evening, made even more memorable in the last scene, wherein Marina gave a very convincing portrayal of Gilda's lingering death. The encore to that evening made it even better. Marina, understanding the miracle which had happened, began to ask questions of her colleague, Brian Montgomery, a returned missionary. She repeatedly accepted invitations to attend church and socials, and a few weeks later, the Montgomerys invited her to their home for a dinner and meeting with the missionary. She accepted the invitation and began a rich and productive relationship with the sister missionaries in Luzern, which culminated in her baptism in June 1988. Reaffirmed to me that opting for faith in 1956 was for me the right course to belief and testimony. I know that I am a common man, a scene sweller at best, a pretty big one, but I also know that I am a child of God striving to become a man of God. And I know that God monitors my life and cares about me even in my relatively insignificant ministry tucked away in Provo, Utah, or Zurich, Switzerland. He cares about me and he cares about you and he will show it. Though I don't presume to know why or when, nor do I agonize about it anymore. I don't know why a Provo man with inoperable brain cancer was instantly healed 7 years ago and remains well, while another Provo woman with cancer and a few weeks to live was promised and given 2 specific years to live and to accomplish her mission. I don't know why, during the blessing of a shattered alcoholic, his mother, 6 months dead, was permitted to enter the room and pour out through my mouth and to the surprise of my counselor and me, a tender blessing and a solemn warning which changed her son's life entirely. I don't know why the recently deceased mother of a young lady missionary appeared to her husband during the setting apart of her daughter, nodding and smiling at him over my shoulder, and subsequently bringing about a total change in his life. I do not know why the Lord intervened in these instances, while in other perhaps similar instances, there was no apparent intervention. I have learned merely to confess his hand in all things and shout Hosanna. I do know that such events are faithful realities which affirm the simple pattern of faith and make vivid the actuality of the world of the Spirit. When I pause to recollect them, to count my blessings, these experiences overwhelm me and make it easier to be nourished by the experiences of an Abraham, a Moses, an Enos, an Alma, a Paul, or a Joseph Smith Jr. The testimonies of innumerable men and women who have left a record of their witness of their spiritual surprises live anew in each occurrence where our God presses close, for they spring from the great pattern. When they are heeded by the faithful who place themselves in God's hand, these surprises of the Spirit, these occasional drafts of joy, become living water, which will always flow forth to nourish and transform, to witness and to testify. It is God's way. Hosanna and amen.
I've entitled my remarks tonight, Revisioning, Dream Quest, Summer 1989. I want to begin my revisioning by describing a childhood experience. I grew up in Cedar City, a small southern Utah town where summers lasted a long time. I think they're shooting at us, Albert. Can you stop it? It makes me nervous. The summers were full of wind and sunshine. My favorite haunt was the hut, a small structure of old power poles my father had built for me, attached to the fence that bordered the cow pasture next door. He built it because I could not resist playing house behind my grandparents' home, where firewood, gigantic trunks, chunks of trees this broad, were stacked, creating inviting, although dangerous, nooks and wooden tables. I would spend hours in the hut, sweeping the dirt floor. It was as hard polished by my feet as those pioneer huts I learned about in church. My dreaming was in rhythm with the rustling of wind through the tall corn stalks in the garden that was in the front of the hut, and the soothing crunching of the grass by the cows in the backyard of the hut. Do you remember how corn leaves feel, snagging your fingers when you rub them the wrong way? I could hear it in the wind, and it was woven into my dreams. One day, it might have been after a morning my brother Fred and I spent selling strawberry Kool-Aid and raisin bar cookies on our front sidewalk, a friend and I left our yard and went to play in another but very familiar yard. 2 houses away, the Woods family had a double-sized garden that was bordered by an irrigation ditch that separated the vegetables from an apple tree and a giant wild rose bush. I can remember the fragrance of the roses. While we were trailing our feet in the ditch and examining the tiny green apples, Mrs. Wood, who was an old gray-haired woman, who was only that to me, an old woman, called to us and told us she had something special to give us. Her present was an old-fashioned baby doll with blue porcelain eyes. We giggled and thanked her. And then we ran back to the ditch, still snickering quietly. Burdened with a gift we didn't want, we dug a hole under the apple tree and we buried the doll. It's probably been 35 years since I buried Mrs. Wood's baby doll, lowered it into its grave without a blanket or a farewell hug. Now I want to resurrect that doll and revision its reception and its burial, but only metaphorically. It must be a revisioning, not a revising or a revisiting. What I want is a re-seeing in the most intense, most feeling way possible. This is because this summer I have learned I cannot see the past or faith in the same way. I'm not the person who was asked to give the talk. I'm actually here under false pretenses. That person had a clear-cut value system, personality, and style of presentation that pleased other people and sometimes herself. But during the last 2 months, I've discovered that in many ways that self was a mask I had created over time. She could have told you charmingly about the amusing way she's decorated the pillars of her faith with clever hints acquired at homemaking meetings as well as literature and film conferences. She knew God loved her, found pleasure in congruence with a great deal of Mormon culture and a quite respectable amount of Mormon theology. I'm resisting the great temptation to put on that mask, to become that person, and let her deliver her version of the pillars of faith. And maybe if I were given the chance next year to speak again, I could describe some other lovely pillars. But right now, I'm caught. Caught in a paradigm shift. Flat-footed in a period of self-examination triggered by major surgery, followed by 4 weeks of isolation and introspection with 10 hours of sleep a day and no children. I mean, no children at all. I had food brought to me and everything, ice water delivered at noon. In preparation for the surgery, I acquired a selection of self-healing tapes, subliminal, not subliminal, and I was also a talented acupressurist who was coincidentally involved in process psychology. As I endeavored to heal the incision from my hysterectomy, I found that there were other, less visible wounds that had to be healed, or at least recognized. In some ways, if we want to pursue the pillars metaphor, I have been a Samson. Pulling down the pillars of the temple of my identity. Samsonette is probably more appropriate, right? There's some qualification to this metaphor, pulling down the temple of my personality by realizing that the pillars of my faith were invisible. The deep structure of my identity has been overthrown. Those underpinnings and faith in meaning that Noam Chomsky and other linguists identified make language operative. But on the surface, I continue to conjugate verbs and speak in complete sentences. It's as if the temple of identity floats above me, sustained by nothing, but still operative and visible to others. I can still conduct a Relief Society meeting, buy school clothes with my children, go to work and revise the film program at BYU and discuss why crazy bread and sugar babies are not an adequate supper for my 8-year-old son. But inside myself, where I'm spending most of my time lately, everything has changed. I'm swept by waves of emotion, pain, sorrow, anger, hostility. Nothing feels or looks the same. Every relationship, every attitude, every memory seems different, calling out for examination and redefinition. I'm only interested in feelings, my feelings, and ideas and other people only as they relate to those feelings. Sometimes when I meet friends or engage in daily tasks, I feel, who is this person anyway? I feel defined by my past, a prisoner of personality. I want to be loved, I want to be cherished, but I'm very suspicious of past strategies I've used to evoke those feelings from other people, from God, and from myself. I understand there are many explanations for this phenomenon. Speaking psychologically, it could be defined as a midlife crisis. This would be age appropriate. Speaking financially, it could be identified as a very personal feminization of poverty. We hit some very bleak times financially recently. Speaking philosophically, you could say I've lost my ontological and epistemological underpinnings, or I simply have a bad case of existential anxiety. Speaking theologically, you could say I'm simply longing for a prelapsarian Edenic experience. Speaking medically, I could be experiencing the PERS syndrome, post-uterus removal stress syndrome. But speaking personally, which is the only mode I wish to summon forth now, it feels like all the systems that gave my life meaning and created my identity have dissolved. Note, this is not at this stage an institutional issue. This is personal. This is not connected with the Book of Mormon, church bureaucracy, Joseph Smith, polygamy, or the patriarchy in general. This is about me. What does this idiosyncratic experience offer others? How is it relevant to faith and pillars thereof? Have any pillars survived this tradition or emerged? Understand, this is in process. It's happening to me now. Writing this presentation in some way offered me a kind of closure, at least rhetorically. But it's ongoing. Tomorrow it will feel differently, and the pillars will be differently. With that caveat, what could possibly be meaningful to you? Though it's very satisfying to have you all listening to me deal with my feelings, and I'm really, you know, provoked into doing some deeper kind of Jungian experience. I'm going to resist that. I'm going to discuss with you the pillars of faith that have emerged from the process for me. And I want to tell you, I think we need a new architectural metaphor for these structures. Mine aren't pillars. They might be landmarks or buoys on the ocean or something like that. Maybe stubs, but they're definitely not pillars. But I'm going to call them that as a conventional means. Pillar one, the process of revisioning, of examining who we are, is painful. I've spent a great deal of my life intellectualizing and humorizing feelings I was reluctant to experience. I now have some 40 years worth of negative emotions to acknowledge or let go or to act on. I'm figuring I'm 43, but 3 years I probably was okay, right? I didn't intellectualize till I got fully verbal about age 2.5 or 3. So 3 years of negative emotions to acknowledge and let go or to act on. I was astonished recently to have a therapist inform me that you don't have to act on everything you felt. That was a revelation to me. One of the reasons I've denied so much anger, disappointment, resentment, and sorrow was that I thought I'd have to do something about them if I acknowledged them. Imagine my amazement at this insight. Let me repeat that in case anyone out there was stuck the same way I was. You don't have to act on everything you feel. Sometimes you can just feel it. Although intellectualizing has interfered with expression of feelings, and my intellectual faculties have not survived the surgery and post-surgical examination process intact, my intellect remains a great source of pleasure to me. This is particularly true when a feeling is embodied in words or embedded in an aesthetic structure as in a poem or a good book or a film. I continue, I'm ashamed to admit, to find relief from even bad books, especially murder mysteries. I've got a list of great recovering books if anyone wants to hear them. Junkyard Dog and 600-Pound Gorilla are very good. Robert Campbell is almost as good as Joseph Campbell if you're going through a paradigm shift. The humorizing I will discuss later. The amendment to Pillar 1 is, living is painful. Not just revisioning, but living. Unacknowledged feelings do not dissipate, but must be dealt with. Pillar two, there is an identity beneath all the belief systems that have dissolved. Although this process has been filled with fear and with pain, I haven't dissolved yet. At some points, I feared that I would, and at others, I hoped that I could. But there's something undeniably me present, constituted by the pain, as well as the denial of that pain. And the revisioning generates assurance of this identity at the very same time it threatens it. Part of the pleasure of revisioning is seeing things with new eyes, with the eyes that I have not looked through for years. With a dual perspective, many things become clearer. One of the unpleasant consequences of this new seeing is recognizing my own profound need for control. Much of my former value systems were imbued with a desire to control the uncontrollable, which included, but was not limited to, the behavior of my husband and children, the existence of evil, the meaning of life, and God's willingness to bless or to blast. One consequence of my new near clear-sightedness is the realization that I have been a manipulative person, and frequently, and this is as bad as my revelations will get, a passive-aggressive person. Also, I experience an unreasonable desire to be loved. At this moment, I am filled with such a passion to be pleasing, to be responded to positively, that I can hardly proceed honestly, but I'm going to try. Pillar 3, God lives. There is a spiritual force which has accompanied me on this journey inward. In my case, much of the presence of divinity is manifested in absence. Like a good instructor in a self-esteem class, God tells me, I know you can do it by yourself. You can handle this one alone. I'm here, but this is your responsibility. Actually, in my former identity, which ended about June 30th, I used to consider this aspect of my life a spiritual gift. In fact, the gift of faith. I have never felt alone or abandoned, though I have felt isolated. The isolation now is temporary and deliberate, not permanent or accidental. I need to be alone so that the divine aspects of me can emerge. God's silence is not deafening, but quickening. God is manifested now at times for me when I'm engaged in efforts that directly affect others. For example, doing initiatory work in the temple, I had a wonderful transcendent experience as I was involved in this dance with the sisters as they passed me from sister to sister. And I thought of the women who had died that I was doing the work for. And it became a dance that grew into a spiral that rose and rose. And I could feel that transcendence, and I could feel the divinity. But for me now, that experience is limited to the service I perform for other people. I am alone performing my own service, quickening the dead within me. Just wanted to make a note that I know questions regarding God's gender and culpability are important for others, but right now they're not relevant for me. Pillar 4. Forces of harmony exist, particularly in the natural world. This harmony emerges in the waves of the ocean, the direction of hairs in a horse's mane, the branching of tree limbs, the layers of red, orange, and lavender that cover Monument Valley at sunset, and the positions assumed by our cats when they relax. If you're interested in first-hand experience, we have a cat named Boots, who naturally assumes the rug cat position with all legs out flat. You're welcome to drop by if you want to see harmony in congruence in action. It's our cat Boots laying in the rug cat position. This harmony is nonverbal, non-self-consciously signifying harmony. This means it doesn't have to mean anything. I'm only beginning to know how to emulate this harmony. I've inhibited a desire that compels me to use it, to make it productive in some way. This harmony is very different from the kind of congruence I earlier experienced with my efforts to fit myself into the expectations of other people or externally created systems. That earlier congruence was a shadow of the kind of joy that comes from this harmony. Pillar 5. Existence is filled with the element of surprise. I'm so glad that Richard chose to talk about that, because surprise, I've determined, is essential to some kind of eternal truth. This is a fact I can't seem to get rid of. Just when I've devised a new system that seems to take into account all of the variables, encompassing all of the feelings, something comes along I hadn't expected. I'm continually surprised by myself, by others, by the intensity of incidents that I had forgotten. I'm also surprised to discover how little some things I used to value highly now matter to me. And surprised to be surprised by that. This isn't a feeling, by the way, I can count on. Just when I think I've risen above interest in material well-being, aside from an occasional slice of warm bread and butter, I get sandbagged by financial matters and have an attack of the money jitters. But then I get surprised to realize I haven't changed as much as I thought. One thing that continually surprises me is the support of friends and family. It's not the kindness of strangers I marvel at, but the kindness of those who know me, especially those who know me well. Often I feel unreliable, unlovable, and unintelligent. I greet the warmth and affection of those I know with astonishment. Like C.S. Lewis, I feel surprised by joy at the discovery of so much goodness freely offered. And I'm most surprised by the riches within, by the discovery of the intensity with which my unacknowledged self has observed and felt. Revisioning, looking again, adds depth to the full range of emotions I'm slowly discovering, not just the painful ones. Pillar 6, life is funny. For me, this certitude has seemed at times questionable. I struggle through gallons of tears, seethe with anger, and vent hostility on both the deserving and the undeserving. And then suddenly, a bolt of light illuminates the absurdity of it all. The recognition of absurdity is not an invitation to dismiss these emotions and facts, but to do honor to the incongruity of their placement. And again, I thank Richard for citing his example at the opera. That's the perfect example of the absurdity and truth of life. Other people who spend time considering the nature of life have transcendent experiences. For me right now, laughter is about the only way to transcend what my contemplation has revealed. Somewhere deep, near where I thought my gift of faith rested, lies the anchor of my soul. And that anchor happens to be the recognition of how truly funny life is. There is, in fact, no need to humorize life. It simply is funny. I understand, coincidentally, not everyone feels this way. I know there are people who find life essentially tragic or solemn. I can't dispute that, but my soul finds it very, very funny. I invite you to drive down I-15 any morning. You'll find plenty of material to convince you life is funny, especially if you try and drive between 59th South and 33rd South northbound this next week. In some ways, I feel this recent crisis has rescued me. Since I didn't feel that I needed or wanted rescuing, the mission has been difficult. I was quite comfortable alternating between periods of lethargy and hyperactivity. In fact, it felt quite normal or comfortable. I could be congruent with that 60s ethic, love, peace, you know, and then alternately demonstrate I was congruent with a be productive work ethic. But I had lost something central to me. I had lost my vision in both senses of that word. The ability to see, which is vision, and that consequence of seeing the divine, both were gone. I had lost something that was crucial to my knowing who I was. Like the baby doll Mrs. Wood gave me, some essential part of me had been buried. During my postoperative recovery, a friend gave me a wonderful book, Interviews with Joseph Campbell, called An Open Life. As I read his discussion of the purpose of myth, I felt a shock of recognition. So the meaning of most myths is finding the dynamic source in your life so that its trajectory is out of your own center and not something put on you by society. He speaks of the real power of the left-hand path, of following your bliss instead of instructions. Our demons, he says, are our own limitations, which shut us off from the realization of the ubiquity of the spirit. And as each of these demons is conquered in a vision quest, the consciousness of the quester is enlarged, and more of the world is encompassed. Finally, with his words, I caught a glimmer of what had been happening to me. I had been launched on a vision quest, but mine had led backward first, revisioning the original visions I had disowned, that I had buried. Campbell knows about the process of disowning. He talks about a person could have the sense of the call, the feeling that there's an adventure for her or him, but if he or she doesn't follow it, but remains in the society because it's safe and secure, then life dries up. He speaks of a woman in West Virginia. When she was a little girl walking through the woods, she heard wonderful music, and when she got home, she forgot. She forgot what it was. Now, this is a woman in her late 60s, he says, who felt that she had missed her life, and only while in psychoanalysis did it come out that the song she had heard was her call. If you have the guts, Campbell says, to follow the risk, to listen to the call, life opens up all along the line. I feel that if one follows what I call one's bliss, the thing that really gets you deep in the gut and that fills your life, doors will open up. They do, he affirms. James Fowler also speaks of finding your vocation in a community, of finding your partnership with God. This is a perfect example of the harmonic convergences I talked about earlier in an intellectual or idea-based way. Scott Peck's Different Drummer also talks about how you build community by emptying, embracing chaos, and then finally creating the unity that's desired. The specifics of my call are not clear. The latest image I know I need to revision is that little girl I used to be, the one who buried the baby doll an old woman gave her. I'm sure that doll has something to do with losing my uterus and my ovaries, but I only know that intellectually. Now I'm on a vision quest to dig up the doll, wipe the dirt from her porcelain blue eyes, look deep into them, and hold her close. After we rock together quietly under the apple tree,
smelling the wild roses. I'll inquire of her why I buried her, what she learned while she was underground, and why every day I look more and more like the old woman who gave her to me.
Well, I'm struck by all the different modes of being and how they in some ways overlap and how they're distinct in other ways. It's been a fascinating evening for me to just sit back and listen. I don't know if any of you can see this fly that's been up here sort of pestering the speakers. I guess the bright side of that is that I don't need to feel so alone up here. I do have some companionship. I think the primary reason I was asked to be here this evening is that Albert Peck hoped I would reflect publicly upon private conversations that I've had with a group I typically call my Utah faith community. That group is a small circle of individuals who I think meet together for understanding and community, as well as for insight into life and spirituality. In that circle of friends, I've been very candid about how I understand my faith development. Albert told me that he hopes I'll say something about how I believe. One concern I have about this public reflection on very private processes is that it might suggest closure that simply doesn't exist. You just heard Sharon say something like this. I'm going to share with you some reflections of my own faith development, but I don't want you to hold me to what I say. Next year, I might have a fundamentally different understanding. I make no apologies for that uncertainty because the potential for fluidity and self-understanding gets at the very heart of what I want to communicate this evening. That losing my firm grasp on knowing has served as a springboard to a richer and fuller spiritual life. I think it's important to note that Albert asked me to say something about how I believe, not why I believe. There is, of course, a crucial difference in these two avenues of exploration. The how focuses on the processes behind belief, while the why focuses on the reasons for belief. I think that the question of how one believes is an issue which necessarily precedes the question of why one believes. For example, I can only come up with one essential reason why I believe in the central religious symbol of God. It is because I have religious experience. Okay, Larry says that he believes in God because he has religious experience. But what does that mean? You can only make sense of my reason for belief if you understand first what I mean by religious experience, and then how I understand experience to be related to a cognitive symbol like God. So let me begin this evening by discussing the issue of how one believes. What I'm going to say is not original. It is grounded in a long tradition of social theorizing about religion. In this century, that tradition has included William James, Rudolf Otto, Martin Buber, Joachim Vach, and more recently, people like Marcel Eliotti and Clifford Geertz and Andrew Greeley. Geertz describes religion as a set of symbols which provides answers to the issues of ultimate meaning of life. Symbols which explain imaginatively what the world is about, symbols which provide templates for shaping human responses to the world and thus that shape the world in which humans live. For example, Greeley suggests that one's picture of God is in fact a metaphorical narrative of God's relationship with the world and the self as a part of the world. What empowers these symbols is that behind them is religious experience, which breathes life into them. This is what Eliotti had in mind when he suggested that it only makes sense to study myth systems that are living. That is, the symbols only retain their vitality in relationship to ultimate meaning if they're connected to ongoing religious experience. This is also what Otto was getting at when he began his book, The Idea of the Holy, by suggesting that his discussion of the holy or transcendence would only make sense to those who had already had the experience of the holy, since the holy itself stood outside of everyday mundane reality, including language. Well, let me stop at this point and apologize for getting so abstract. I'm a sociologist. I can't help it. If you're normal, at least some of you have just finished thinking about where you're going to have lunch tomorrow. So let me try to move my discussion to a more accessible terrain by summarizing what I view as the essential process of religion. Again, this is not original. It's grounded in the tradition I've just discussed, and especially in the work of Andrew Greeley. I can summarize religion in four words: experience, image, story, community. The beginning of religion, its raw power, its core is experience. Religion at its core, as religious experience, is part of the non-cognitive portion of being human. Long hours, doing a poor job, and still only getting half of what I needed to do done. Added to all of that was the fact that we were in the middle of an inversion. I knew that it had been cold and gray yesterday, that it was cold and gray today, that it would be cold and gray tomorrow. If someone had stopped me and asked me my opinion about most anything, I would have simply told them that things stunk. As I hurried down the street, trying not to be late for yet another appointment, I saw a weary young mother at a bus stop struggling with an armful of packages and a young child, and she was losing the struggle. The child was obviously in an adventurous mood, and the mother had no way of coping with that mood. Well, I'm a sucker for a 2-year-old who wants to play. So I stopped and told the mother to look after her packages. I'd watch the child until the bus came. I made faces at the child. He made faces at me. And we generally had a good time for the few moments until the bus came. As the mother climbed aboard the bus and got her packages settled, I picked up the child and got ready to hand him to his mother. Now, at that moment, the child suddenly realized that he had a tough decision to make. Either he could cling to me and have some more fun after the bus drove away, or he could go to his mother. Now, even though playing has its seductive features, after the boy struggled with the choice for a few moments, he reached out for his mother. When she took him, as the bus doors closed, she looked down on me and she smiled. As I turned away from the bus and continued my walk down State Street, my world was changed. As I breathed in the brisk air, I looked down the street that was filled with handsome people and lined with the most exquisite frost-covered trees. All around me was a beautiful city, the city of my tradition, the city of my ancestors, and this beautiful city was clothed in white. And the burdens I'd been carrying with me only minutes before no longer seemed so oppressive. When I met my friend, she asked me what had happened, because I was so obviously transformed from what I had been 15 minutes earlier when I talked with her on the phone. And I told her that I had just seen a Madonna. Well, that story is a piece of fiction, and it helps illustrate how a story can short-circuit cognitive description to get at raw experience. And that raw experience is something more than the cognitive description itself. As I told it, it called forth similar experience for some of you. For others, it recalled parallel experiences. Life is a process of storytelling. We're all storytellers. Telling stories about lives give them a sense of cohesion and meaning. Most of us have stories about decisive events in our lives. A church or religion is a storytelling community. Furthermore, the images you inherit from your tradition give you images and symbols from which to make sense of raw religious experience. I think they also predispose you to particular frequencies of having those experiences. Thus, there's a feedback loop in the sequence of experience, image, story, community, community provides you with images and stories that predispose you to have the experience and help you interpret the experience. Upon reflection, we realize that virtually all religion have stories about sacred space and time, including the creation of the world, the establishment of true religion, and accounts of breakthroughs to the holy or the transcendent. In Mormon tradition, there are also stories about the reestablishment of true religion and the creation of Zion, among other things. Now, I want to say something more about the nature of religious experience, but before I do, I want to turn to something of an autobiographical account of how I now understand my faith development. While I'm a little embarrassed to tell you that story, I think it's what Albert really had in mind when he invited me to be on the panel tonight. After telling the story, I'll say something about religious experience itself and then my understanding of how the role of religious experience in my life has changed over time. The first time I went into some detail about my faith development with members of my Utah faith community was an evening when we were sharing with one another books that had influenced our lives. That evening, I indicated that books had played a central role in how I understood my own faith. I think I discussed four books: Dietrich Bonhoeffer's The Cost of Discipleship, William Barrett's Irrational Man, Jürgen Habermas's Knowledge and Human Interest, and Thich Nhat Hanh's The Miracle of Mindfulness. I first read Bonhoeffer and Barrett when I was 21, and it was while I read them that something became clear that I had only sensed before. I knew that text and reader occasionally came together in such a way as to produce outcomes that could be transformative. Furthermore, whether or not this transformation took place was at least as much a function of where the reader was at in his or her own personal development as it was a function of what was in the text itself. In addition, I realized that for myself, this dialogical relationship with the text was only possible when I could view questioning and struggling with the text as a non-heretical act. Ironically, I found that while this process of questioning and struggling was a source of tremendous spiritual growth, I was uncomfortable using books from my own religious tradition because the process of questioning and struggle was confounded with issues of personal heresy. In any event, let me say something about how these books and a few others entered into my self-understanding of religious experience, faith, and knowing. When I picked up Bonhoeffer's The Cost of Discipleship, I really didn't know what to expect. All I knew was that everyone else at BYU was reading C.S. Lewis, so I certainly wasn't going to read Lewis. At the time I first read Bonhoeffer, I didn't agree with much of what he said, and today I probably agree with even less. But this lack of agreement was a liberating experience, which allowed me to enter into a form of dialogue with Bonhoeffer. The most profound message I took from him still influences the way I understand religion to some degree. That central message was that religion is not just about, or even primarily about, the pre-existence or life after death. Rather, religion is first and foremost about the here and now, about how we relate to God. In this context, we obey God not because we want to go to heaven, but because we love God. This, in part, is the distinction between priestly religion and prophetic religion, and Bonhoeffer clearly pulled me towards the prophetic dimension of religion. The call to discipleship, according to Bonhoeffer, is not a call to a set of rules and laws which we must obey in order to obtain future rewards. Rather, the call to discipleship is the immediate call to grace. To quote Bonhoeffer, "Such grace is costly because it calls us to follow, and it is grace because it calls us to follow Jesus Christ. It is costly because it costs a man his life, and it is grace because it gives a man the only true life. Grace is costly because it compels a man to submit to the yoke of Christ and follow him. It is grace because Jesus says, 'My yoke is easy and my burden is light.'" The call to discipleship is a gift of grace, and the call is inseparable from the grace. The disciple is dragged out of his relative security into a life of absolute insecurity, from a life which is observable and calculable into a life where everything is unobservable and fortuitous, out of the realm of finite into the realm of infinite possibilities. Again, it is no universal law. Rather, it is the exact opposite of all legality. Christ calls, the disciple follows. That is grace and commandment in one. Bonhoeffer taught me to seek Christ in the here and now, and that through Christ I would know how to live. This gave me a firm anchor and a sense of ultimate meaning. It seemed to me that what mattered in life was Christ, and if we loved Christ, we would be his disciples. The act of discipleship was also the act of accepting God's grace into our life. Before reading Bonhoeffer, I already had as a part of my life what I call religious experience, the sense of God's presence or of the transcendent. I now was convinced that through that experience, I could and did know things. That is, I had the experience of transcendence. I interpreted that experience with a particular symbolic framework, a relatively traditional LDS framework. Because the religious experience had a sense of ultimacy about it, the symbolic apparatus surrounding it, the images, stories, and community, also took on a sense of ultimacy. This sense was further solidified when I read William Barrett's Irrational Man, which is a very accessible study of existential philosophy. Although Barrett may not have agreed with my understanding of his message, he provided me with a philosophical framework through which I could understand many of my struggles over faith during my adolescent years. In addition, I felt that I could more fully and compassionately understand the modern individual's encounter with radical uncertainty and my own ability to overcome radical uncertainty through the non-rational experience of God, or if you will, through the non-rational witnessing of the Holy Ghost. I sincerely knew things, and I joyously testify to the miracle of knowing. And then I read Jürgen Habermas. And then I didn't know anything. My images, stories, and community all seemed to come unglued. Habermas is traditionally identified as a part of the Frankfurt School of Critical Social Theory. I read his book, Knowledge and Human Interest, in the spring of 1979 when I was 23. It was for me a stunning book. It changed the way I understood virtually everything. The book is a radical critique of knowledge, beginning with Kant and ending with modern positivism and psychoanalysis. It is a critical reflection on the connections between knowledge and human interests, and it finally focuses on the question, how is reliable knowledge possible? Before reading Habermas, I knew the answer to that question. After reading Habermas, I had no answer. Yet something curious and completely unexpected happened in the midst of this crisis of intellect and faith. Religious experience continued, even as my understanding of it and just about everything else came unglued. That was equally stunning. I cannot communicate to you how grateful I am that it did continue. The persistence of that experience meant that even as I knew nothing, I was not left without a sense of meaning and hope. And I must tell you, at that point, I felt desperately dependent on this force, even though I no longer cognitively understood it. While over the years that have passed, my sense of gratefulness and dependency have not diminished. I have since read many things which help me place my own experience in a larger context, to have a greater sense of confidence with images and stories which seem to get at the religious experience, which has remained a constant in my life. For example, I remember reading the first two chapters of Peter Berger's The Heretical Imperative on a flight from Dallas to Madison, Wisconsin. As I sat in my seat reading, I was having wave after wave of God's presence come over me, or what we might call in our tradition, a constant burning in the bosom. I looked around me and, you know, everyone else was eating their dinner and I was having this transformative process. In chapter one of that book, entitled Modernity as the Universalization of Heresy, I seem to be reading about significant aspects of my own crisis of faith and intellect. And although it was not the first time I realized this, I recognized that I was not alone in my struggle for understanding. In chapter 2, entitled Religion, Experience, Tradition, Reflection, I seem to be reading about my religious experience. It's always startling to pick up a book and read something that seems so autobiographical. I had a similar experience when I read Rudolf Otto's The Idea of the Holy, in particular the material dealing with Mysterium Tremendum, or the mystery which must be trembled at. Again, while Otto didn't get it exactly right for me, he seemed to be describing significant aspects of my experience with the Holy or God. Let me at this point say just a little more about the nature of religious experience in my life by using the concepts of Berger. Berger draws upon Alfred Schutz and his concept of multiple realities, as well as William James's concept of subuniverses. And he argues that reality is not experienced as one unified whole, and these different zones have greatly differing qualities. For instance, the individual experiences one zone of reality while they're dreaming and quite a different zone while they're awake. Another instance is the zone of reality one enters in intense aesthetic experience, say getting lost in music. And this zone is quite different from the reality of ordinary everyday life. Ordinary everyday reality is the zone which seems the most real most of the time. It is also the one we can share most easily with other people. Since we inhabit this reality with other people, its existence and major characteristics are constantly being confirmed for us. Thus, from the perspective of everyday reality, which we are in right now, these other realities are experienced as alien zones, or as enclaves, or holes within this everyday reality. While everyday reality is massively real, it's also very precarious. It can be lost as easily as falling asleep or listening to Mozart's music. And from within the experience of one of these ecstatic ruptures, the ordinary world is not only is relativized, but it now seems to have previously unperceived qualities. While religious experience or experience with the supernatural is one of these subuniverses or alternative realities. Furthermore, if we believe self-reports, it appears that many people have these religious experiences. Berger describes this experience in a way which seems to come close to how I would give expression to it. He says that it is radically, overwhelmingly other, completely different from myself, completely different from mundane reality. What is encountered is a complete world set over and against the world of mundane experience. The supernatural is no longer an enclave within the ordinary world, rather the supernatural looms over, haunts, even envelops the ordinary world. This new reality seems to be ultimate reality, by comparison with which ordinary reality pales in insignificance. The experience opens up the vista of a cohesive and comprehensive world. Within this other reality, there is a sense of startling and totally certain insights. This reality is experienced as being in a different dimension of space and time. And from within this reality, the categories of ordinary reality are radically contested and exploded. The experience also transforms the perception of both self and others. While the experience is emphatically other than ourselves, it at the same time affirms ourselves at the very center of our being, and it integrates us within the order of the cosmos. And it is the experience itself which does that task. Let me conclude by reflecting on how my understanding of the role of religious experience has changed over time. The crucial component of my changing understanding is that when image, story, and community came unglued, experience did not go away. Before I encountered and experienced the radical critique of human knowledge, my primary focus was on image, story, and community. And I used religious experience to legitimate image, story, and community. That is, the most profound experiences of my life, what I've discussed this evening as religious experiences, were tied up with image, story, and community. And consequently, I assigned those things ontological standing. I knew images, stories, and community were true because when I reflected upon them, I had transformative and empowering experiences. However, I have experienced the movement from knowing to faith as a positive development in my own life. When I no longer knew things, my primary focus became the experience itself. That is, the experience itself became religion in its most fundamental sense. Not image, not story, not community. Because I don't know how to guarantee that I'll have that experience, Every day is a glorious mystery. I live by faith and hope. Nothing is more important in my life than the experience. It exists at a more primitive level than everything else. I experience it as ontologically prior to anything else. Now, for me, the gateway to the experience is the image or symbol of God. I don't know if I've got the God image exactly right. I suspect that it will continue to evolve and develop, but it resonates for me. It seems to lead me to the core experience of my life. Today, that symbol and the others that are built up around it are both more uncertain and vibrant. And in many ways, I feel more dependent upon the symbols and stories than ever before. I clearly feel a greater sense of dependency on God or the experience of the holy than I did when I knew things. When I knew things, the images and stories seemed to be the primary source of meaning. Now the experience itself is my primary source of meaning. The experience is self-validating. I sense hope in the face of the experience. I sense that I'm a better lover, a gentler person, and closer to grace when I encounter the experience. I'm constantly amazed how the hope which emerges from religious experience destroys old structures of perception and opens up new ones, giving me new ways of seeing. I'm grateful for images of religious experience which predispose us to have the experience again and which give us hope by providing memories of an experience that points beyond itself to the possibility of meaning. I'm grateful for the stories that allow us to collectively share those images and which provide a sense of community. But most of all, I'm grateful for the experience itself, which is more fundamental than images, stories, or community. I believe because I have this experience, which comes gratuitously and which leads me and so many others to posit the beyond. I now sense that regardless of what happens to my images, stories, and community, that experience, as the core of religion, will remain as the pillar of my faith.
Can you stand to hear one more? It's been a long evening, I'm sure. In fact, since I can't offer you a rest hymn, would you like to just stand and stretch and touch your toes and unwrap that noisy piece of candy you have in your pocket and complain to your neighbor a little bit and ask what time it is? And I'll just go ahead and start, and when you feel the blood come back into your posterior, you can maybe concentrate on what I have to say. A dear friend of mine, after hearing me worry and complain about having to give this, even though I agreed of my own free will, as this song said, suggested that I merely stand up and say, "Beats the hell out of me," and sit down. But I've now gone to the trouble of writing all this, so you have to listen to it, I suppose, unless you'd like to take this moment to discreetly disappear. I was never particularly aware of how many pillars there were in Washington until being asked to give this speech. The anxiety at having to define my faith was such that it was infinitely easier to analyze pillars. So as I drove past battery after battery of pillars, passing the Capitol, the National Archives, the National Gallery, the Departments of Agriculture, Commerce, Justice, even the new high-rise condominium on Pennsylvania Avenue, and especially the memorials, I would ask, why was that put there? And what is it about me and my continuing commitment to the Church of Christ that serves this function? When the terror of not knowing what to say would subside, I could notice that pillars served a variety of purposes. Some, like those at the Jefferson Memorial, clearly support the weight of the entire structure. Others, like those of the Lincoln Memorial, support only the outer rim or porch. The last use worth mentioning is the pillar's decorative function. In both old and new buildings, pillars would be placed under very small ledges or beside doors, not for purposes of bearing weight, but to add grace and line and, of course, prestige. I began to realize my problem was not so much in identifying the pillar of my faith, but distinguishing among the various props integrated into my personal house of faith, which were merely decorative, which were supporting porches or introducing entrances, and which were bearing the weight of the entire structure. From the beginning, the decorative pillars seemed the easiest to recognize. Foremost among them is, I think, my facility in the Mormon culture. I know how to dress like a Mormon, and I know how to talk like a Mormon. I know what is a polite question, and I know the helpful responses to the impolite ones. I know the organizational structure and the requisite amount of respect appropriate to each layer. Though I have never admitted it, and most would never guess, I like being an insider in this community. I enjoy understanding the nuances of our relationships to each other. Sometimes I imagine it must be like living in a small town that knows no geographical boundaries. The mayor is my cousin, and I went to school with the sheriff. I know how to avoid indigestion at the local restaurant and can pick the best conversations in front of the dry goods store. I have learned how to avoid the bullies and other doctrinal eccentrics. I know the stories in the town cemetery, feeling the connectedness of past and present. I know about lost pages of manuscript, oxen who have been healed, potatoes baked for late-coming handcart companies, even wine from Dixie and massacres in the meadows. All of this is a pillar of sort. It has the look of a pillar. It adds line and image to who I am. It gives me an identity, even credibility, regardless of any interior resources. To the uninitiated, five generations of Mormon progenitors and 40 years of experience in the culture, including a two-year mission and BYU education, can even seem to be the cause rather than the effect of my Mormonism. In my experience, however, these cultural experiences and social graces cannot serve the function, though they may ape the form of a pillar. None of these things are of real help to me when I have to decide the hard questions, such as whether to support the Equal Rights Amendment or how to support the bishop who doesn't want me to support it. And when a desirable man offers me his bed, it's not memories of the wonderful conversations in front of the dry goods store that informs my decision. These decorative pillars seem to crumble very easily under stress. I have a harder time admitting to the second type of pillar, namely that which supports only a porch without bearing much of the building's weight. However, going to what has always seemed to me the core of the most consistently positive experience, I even have to admit that my understanding of our theology is merely an appendage to my house, and confess that my love of the Scriptures and love for the life of the Spirit is not what keeps me going back again and again to the church. Indeed, the secondary pillar includes many exciting experiences, even miracles, such as you've heard described tonight. If I were to describe them here, you would no doubt recognize them from your own experience. Healings and mendings, both great and small. Fires of testimonies, heard and given. Revelation of hearts and minds, as well as information. Tongues to speak the ineffable. Even wisdom and understanding. These gifts have spared me much confusion and given me moments of great joy. Yet, however much I love these things, I must confess that their usefulness is limited in the face of demands for sacrifice, obedience, virtue, and consecration. They are supportive. They give me signals of what's important. They even announce a doorway or two. But I know they do not in themselves sustain me. They do not bear the load of the weight of this building that is my spiritual life. Indeed, these experiences and my knowledge of what we commonly phrase as the church's truthfulness has in the past seemed to be the very weight bearing down upon, rather than the pillar shoring up my faith. I have only once said I didn't know whether the church was true. I was 8 or 9 years old, and each member of my Tucson Ward primary class was to participate in the monthly testimony meeting. Never wanting to do what was expected of me, I stood up and said, "I don't know whether the church is true or not. But someday I hope I will." I remember it so well, not because there were any repercussions, but because I knew I had lied. I did know it was true. And I searched in vain to remember how or when it first came to me. As the years went on, I gave up trying to find out why. I simply tried to change my mind. It never worked. Finally, 20 years later, having failed to change my mind, I just changed my life. I left for what turned out to be a surprisingly long time. In those years, while I lived the life of a Gentile with as much zeal as I had the life of a Mormon, I never talked myself out of my testimony. I never rationalized my lifestyle as acceptable to God's intentions for me or a superior choice to that of an active Mormon. I was happier, and that was what mattered to me. I was tired of being right. I was ready to be happy. While in Kobe on a mission, I would hear the local bishop frequently bear his testimony that in the church was the way of happiness in this life, not just the life to come. I envied him.
The truthfulness of the gospel did not work that way in my life. Instead, it inspired a sadness so profound that it could only be overcome by religious zealotry. Important stuff. The important stuff, the crisis for me, came and still lies in the ontological questions related to my relationship to God and the opportunity to realize my spiritual potential through the church. In 1979, I was a second-year law student clerking in San Francisco. The issues raised in the previous 5 years of acrimonious debate in Utah were not new to me. My first conscious consideration of such questions was at 14. I had abstractly wondered what God did with a female Moses. What did he do with women who had the spiritual attributes and potential of a prophet? What happens to the parable of the talents or the doctrines associated with the resurrection when applied to the present and future spiritual state of these women? Or were there, by definition, never any women who had these attributes of faith and testimony? I immediately dropped the question, never asking it aloud. I was too intent upon denying the central fact of my life, that I was a woman, and no amount of internalizing the male values of the church would change my ecclesiastical destiny as dictated by my biology. 2 years in the mission field finally forced this truth upon me, and I returned to Utah in 1973, intellectually confused about what I was supposed to be. Emotionally, however, I had a level of clarity that had escaped me intellectually. For example, when a friend of mine asked me if I had heard of this new magazine called Ms. and described it to me, I said without hesitation, "Eloise, I can't afford to feel those feelings." I was shamed by this manifest fear of an idea. In the 6 years that followed, I did feel those feelings and explored in depth the ideas raised by the feminist renaissance of the 70s. That exploration inevitably led to a significant involvement in the Donnybrook of the Utah State IWY meeting and the national meeting in Houston. Numbed by the experience and fully terrorized by the raw power of the church in political matters, I, like so many of my sisters, hit the deck. For me, that meant withdrawing from both feminism and Mormonism. I just faded away into law school and benign inactivity in the church. But one decision leads to another, as we all know, and in the summer of 1979, I was facing a decision that would take me beyond inactivity and constitute a deliberative act in violation of church law. I was having a terrible time making this decision, but had promised to make it by the time I picked Mark up at the airport. I took the roundabout way, all the while muddling through how I would respond to the demands of our relationship. Driving down the East Bay, I noticed the Oakland Temple on the skyline and instinctively drove up to the hills to it. I suppose it was a superstitious hope that proximity to it might provide me with some intelligence or strength I could not muster internally. Because of my attire and the fact of its being Sunday, the missionaries at the visitor center assumed I was not a member of the church, and I did not correct them. I was searching for something and hoped that the uncomplicated dialogue would help, like the rehearsal of a catechism. Maybe there was something I had missed in my education or had forgotten that they would remind me of and restore my strength and desire. When they asked me if I knew about the Mormon Church, I answered that I was a law student in Salt Lake City and had had many opportunities to discuss the church. They asked if I could believe that God spoke through prophets today and started to tell me the story of the restoration. I admitted that I had heard the missionary lesson several times. They turned then to the Book of Mormon story, and again, not wanting to waste their time or to toy with them, I quickly admitted that I had read it and was very moved by it. By this time, they too were wondering why I was there. At each juncture in the conversation, they had offered me the balm they had, and I admitted that I had already received it, but it was not enough to motivate me to affiliate with the saints and to live the law of the gospel. We all sat there for a moment in silence, wondering what my problem was. They thinking, "Why isn't she baptized?" Me thinking, "Why am I leaving this?" Finally, I started to speak in an effort to reassure them that they had done all they could for me. Not having thought it through myself, I heard the words only as I spoke them. I said, "You know how in your church you value the wholeness of the family and emphasize the necessity of each parent's contribution to the emotional and spiritual development and well-being of the child, that without the father, the son in particular will have difficulty knowing himself and what he can be, his rights and duties, obligations and opportunities. And likewise, that without the mother, the daughter is going to suffer confusion. I said, I guess your church frightens me because I feel that together with all these truths we've talked about, it offers me confusion as a daughter of God. While aggressively asserting spiritual distinctions between the sexes, it offers me no understanding of my rights and duties, my path of spiritual development. Or worse, it entices me to set aside my womanliness and be, for lack of a better word, a spiritual tomboy. I left feeling sadly relieved of a great burden, the burden of trying to fit. I felt as if the Lord had heard my soul's complaint and released me. It was as if I had been born in the midst of a scout-o-rama and someone had given me permission not to spend my days building campfires, raising tents, and tying knots. As if someone had said to me, it's okay if this feels like something you don't want to do. You're not crazy. I even heard a hint of you're right in thinking that things are a little confusing, and it can be stunning to your growth in camp. Now, this was no epiphany revealing a true path, no justification for thinking the scout-o-rama was wrong. I simply felt relieved of what had been for me a life on the Procrustean bed of the church's single-minded interpretation of the gospel through the male experience and values. I was relieved of the social pressure to sleep in the great outdoors, talk about cars, or learn what a nautical mile is. Not that there's anything per se wrong with these things. They just were not going to get me anywhere. I was not a Boy Scout. And for the first time in my life, I felt that this was okay. I had asked, and he had given me liberally, upbraiding me not. However, I also lost all the sure measures provided by the Procrustean bed that had secured my life and informed so many of my choices. And in the years that followed, I wandered far afield trying to find alternatives. But before I get to that, permit me to clarify something. There are two central weaknesses to the analogy of my youth in the church to being sequestered in a scout-o-rama. First, the analogy can seem to trivialize the work which men are doing in the church today. That is not my meaning at all, and takes the metaphor too literally. I believe that men are accomplishing many great and good things in the church. Second, the analogy trivializes the spiritual effect of male domination on all aspects of the church's structure. This, too, couldn't be further from the truth of what I feel. But back to the story. I left the temple grounds feeling that progress for me required letting go of the church for a while. I concluded that if I wanted to comprehend and access my rights and obligations as a daughter, I needed a break from the program designed for the sons. Ironically, I needed to do this because I had so fully learned their ways and adopted their spiritual values. When I had heard the stories of Daniel, the sons of Mosiah, Peter, and Brigham, I not only loved the stories, I wanted to do what they did. I wanted to face the lions, speak with the tongue of an angel, redeem myself from denial, and demonstrate unfaltering knees. I wanted to put on the whole armor of God, fight the good fight, and run the good race. I studied the scriptures, said my prayers, gave talks in increasingly larger forms, learned and practiced the spiritual gifts, only to find myself all dressed up with no place to go. The church simply had no public use for those arts and women. All the time I had been listening to the stories, the message had been intended for someone else. And worst of all, I had come out of the experience thinking that something was wrong with me for wanting these things. I was made to feel that I was unnatural, not fully formed, unclean in the finest of Greek and Hebrew traditions. And all because I wanted to do what Daniel, Peter, Brigham, even my father and brother did. Once after a lecture series on women and religion, a man said to me incredulously, "You don't want the priesthood, do you?" Although it didn't do justice to my thoughts on the subject, I couldn't resist saying, "Don't you?" If it were not for a patriarchal blessing, I could simply conclude that my expertise at so many of the priestly arts is an ironic result of my attempts to escape the stigma of being female in this church. The attempt to qualify by effort and talent where I couldn't qualify by birth. But the madness of my situation was that I had received the blessing. Does the pot complain why thou hast made me thus? Yes, though it usually doesn't do much good. But now the potter had told me I didn't have to sit on the shelf. I felt as if God had released me from the gifts and the conflicts. I felt as if God were giving me permission to not try to fit myself, my hopes, and gifts into the program of the church. In the years that followed, though my love for the church did not diminish, my need for it did. Though my conviction regarding its unique endowment of the keys to the kingdom did not abate, my trust in its benevolent use of those keys in my behalf did. I took more responsibility for the care of my own life. As I have mentioned, for the next several years, I lived the life of a Gentile as enthusiastically as I did that of a saint. I always expected that I would have to report on my stewardship someday, that God would invite me to be more responsive to the facts of spiritual life. Though I took great care not to volunteer to give that report, I would periodically drop in on a ward meeting. I thought of it, in the same metaphor that it has been used, though to a different meaning, I think, I thought of it as taking my pulse, trying to ascertain if it was time for me to do something about this unfinished business. By 1982, I was living in Washington, D.C., and I dropped in on the Chevy Chase ward to take my pulse and almost left in a coma. I knew a few people there, one of whom was the first counselor in the bishopric, who took the occasion to ask if I would teach one of the gospel doctrine classes every other week. I was thunderstruck with a mixture of foreboding and chagrin. Chagrin because, notwithstanding my studied expectation that God would call for an accounting, I never expected this. I was filled with foreboding because I had no confidence that I was ready to act within the structure of the church. Yet I knew this calling could not be rejected. Not that I didn't try. What ensued was a dialogue as strange as the one in Oakland. I asked, "Does the bishop know about this?" "Yes, it was his idea." "No, I mean, what I mean is, does the bishop know how I live my life?" Well, it never came up. So being a lawyer, I tried to reposition my argument. I said, "Will I have to change how I live my life?" "He didn't say you did." I could feel myself trapped, straining at the net. I thought, surely at some point he will set limits I can't abide that make him withdraw the offer or justify my rejecting it. But it stood out there. I couldn't give it up yet, though. I said, "Do I have to attend any meetings besides Sunday school on the week I teach?" And he said, "No." I said, "Do I have to be sustained?" "Yes, but you don't have to be present." Do I have to be set apart?" "Yes, but we can do it privately here." I felt drawn and just short of being quartered. Because I knew this was the Lord's handiwork, and because I could not give up the hope of someday fitting in the church, I had to accept this call. In the year that followed, I continued to resist any other involvement with the institution and to respond as purely as possible to the promptings of the Spirit. What I eventually had to do, of course, was to change my life to conform to the law of the church. I don't want to cause any confusion about that. I now understand that paradoxically this was accomplished by giving me an opportunity to use my gifts without any demands from the church's structure. Finally, one day, having escaped to the Blue Ridge at a yoga retreat, I sat meditating upon the conflicts which I tolerated, even fostered, in my life in an attempt to ward off the threat I felt from the institution of the church. It came to me as surely as any revelation I have ever received that if I truly wanted to know God the Mother and be called her daughter, I would have to conform myself to the law of the gospel and make peace with her Son's church. I bowed to this necessity and in doing so found the pillar of my faith. In the few months from the time I submitted to his will and traveled the distance from the bar to the temple, without so much as a touch of vertigo, Christ has cared for me with a sweet genius I cannot adequately describe. It was in those days of learning him that I found the thing upon which my life could be ordered in such a way as to bear all the old and some new stresses. It is, I think, this pillar that will remain standing into eternity years after other parts of my temple have worn away to dust. It is most simply and ambiguously stated as the love of God. I fear this answer will disappoint you, that you would have me say something that sounds less sentimental, more exotic, Or maybe I'm the one who's embarrassed to be talking like this after all the years of intellectual pyrotechnics. Nevertheless, I must say unequivocally with John that God is defined by the love he offers us, and that this love is enough. His grace is sufficient. To use the metaphor given to me tonight, just as surely as the pillars surrounding the memorial to Thomas Jefferson securely hold the marble canopy high over his head, creating a secure womb-like world, so also the love of God as manifest through his Son securely upholds the life that is submitted to him. The strength provided by this peace is sufficient to withstand the cruelest neglect and bear the weight of the most obnoxious of public judgments. In truth, many of the pressures remain. Generally speaking, women are not valued in our culture at large except as a means to collective ends, as mothers and mates. Today, unlike in my youth, women can pray in sacrament meetings, and other welcome changes have been made in the way in which women are treated within the structure. However, our roles are still largely perceived as temporal, and we are subject to ambiguous, if any, spiritual direction. Our exaltation is generally taught as derivative of our husbands and children. Sisters, I do not stand here revealing parts of my life to you in this way, merely to encourage you to bloom where you're planted, or to say that God's love will enable you to endure. I am trying to say something else. The power structure of the church can be very distracting when one is trying to find her way to God. It is more than easy, it is sometimes thought to be required of us, that we believe men stand in a relationship to God that we do not, that they have rights to access the powers of heaven that we do not. I'm here to say that this is not my experience. Rather, what men have is expectations of and opportunities for empowerment that we do not have. By virtue of the fact that very little in the way of spiritual achievement is expected or even desired of us, very little is sought by us. By virtue of the fact that we are circumscribed by the type of church callings available to us and by the ecclesiastical authority granted within those callings, we are seldom forced to go to God and to spiritually stretch to perform our duties. Like ladies of the 18th century, we have been educated to perform the arts of and to stay within the drawing rooms of our society. Consequently, our grasp always exceeds our reach. And for fear of having our hands slapped, we are waiting for permission to expand into the world that exists outside. What I have experienced is that not only is it permissible, but it is incumbent upon us to do other and more than what we have been doing. If we will refocus our attention so that it lies upon Christ, the righteous desires of our hearts will be granted. We will be endowed to receive the rights of the fathers and mothers and be ordained to administer the same, namely to be saviors upon Mount Zion, even to see the face of God and live. These rights are to be had in his house and fulfilled at his hand through the principles and ordinances of the gospel found in this church. Sisters, the Lord loves you as well. If you love him and come to him with a desire to receive these endowments of earthly rights to heavenly powers, it is then within his power to bestow them upon you and to give you the opportunity, yes, even in his church, to exercise them. This is his work and glory, and it can bring you happiness in this life, not just the life to come. That is why we worship him, which is what I have tried to do tonight. Thank you.
Thank you all. We've been enlarged tonight, both in understanding and in love. Michael Hicks will conclude with a performance, and Reed Hunter will offer a benediction.
So as not to risk the crackling of the house system, move to the pulpit. And we opened with a song about standing apart. We'll close with a song about gathering together. When I was very young, I was brought up in the Baptist church, and then when I hit puberty, I joined the Pentecostal church for obvious reasons. And that was where I learned this song, which has never been in an LDS hymn book, although there's been one sort of like it called Shall We Meet Beyond the River. It's been in every LDS hymn book until 1985, at least in this century, and I've never heard it sung. But this is the real song, and I hope that you will sing in the chorus as you learn it. Shall we gather at the river where bright angels' feet have trod, with its crystal tide forever flowing by the throne of God? Yes, we'll gather at the river, the beautiful river. Gather with the saints by the river that flows by the throne of God. Soon we'll reach the shining river. Soon our pilgrimage will cease, and our happy hearts will quiver with the melody of peace. Yes, we'll gather at the river, the beautiful river. Gather with the saints by the river that flows by the throne of God again. Yes, we'll gather at the river, the beautiful river. Gather with the saints by the river that flows by the throne of God. That flows by the throne of God.